I would go out with the starters, long toss with them, do their stretching, do their whole routine, come back in, do flat ground, and then join the reliever stretch, you know, an hour later, and then do the same thing again from the other side.
Welcome into another episode of Baseball America's From Phenom to the Farm. I'm your host, Kyle Bandujo. Today, I'm talking to MLB's first ever switch pitcher, Pat Vendetti. We're obviously going to talk a lot about switch pitching and Pat's journey from a college walk-on at Creighton with a unique skill to a guy who developed both arms to big league quality, debuting with the A's in 2015. He breaks down the extra work that went into that, how he decided which side to use against switch hitters, and how he always picked the team he signed with during minor league free agency. Really, really unique episode. I loved hearing Pat walk through all the nuances of how he worked his left side, how he worked his right side. Really glad he stopped by the show. Episodes of From Phenom to the Farm drop every other Tuesday. If you enjoy this one, subscribe wherever you get your podcast and go check out past interviews. And if you haven't yet, leave a 5-star rating and a review. Also, make sure to subscribe to BaseballAmerica.com and the BA podcast feed for all amateur baseball and prospect news. We are into the college baseball postseason, my favorite time of the year. Also covering minor league baseball. The prospect hot sheet is going. Always a good time to subscribe to Baseball America. And with that, let's talk to Pat Vendetti. All right, joining in for today's episode of From Phenom to the Farm, he was a 20th round pick of the Yankees in 08 out of Creighton, former big league switch pitcher, Pat Vendetti. Pat, thank you so much for joining the show.
Hey, looking forward to it. Should be some fun.
Yeah, Pat, you are the you're the first switch pitcher, big league switch pitcher to join the show because you are the first big league switch pitcher ever. Might have company soon.
I think I will.
Yeah, I want to, I mean, let's jump into the obvious. Pat, how did you do what you do? How did becoming a switch pitcher, you know, how did that originate?
You know, it was just an idea that came from my father, who thought if there could be switch hitters, why not a switch pitcher? I'm a natural righty. Everything in life to this day that I do is right-handed. I cannot, you know, throw a football if I'm not practicing often. I can't play golf left-handed, can't shoot a basketball right, none of it. But he developed that left side for me, starting at an early age when I was 3. And when you're playing catch in the backyard, it's one of those things that you enjoy doing with dad. And it honestly, it took a long time for that left hand to develop. And it wasn't until probably my sophomore year at Creighton, when I dropped down sidearm, that I started to have a decent amount of success left-handed. But, you know, dropping down sidearm there and being able to spin a slider from that slot for the first time in my life kind of became easy. So that made the whole pitching thing a little more efficient too.
You know, as I'm sure listeners are tired of me hearing me talk about my own career, but as someone who dropped down from every angle and tried everything, I also wish my dad had said, hey, maybe try some things left-handed at a young age. But as you're grown up and as you get into high school and you're having success right-handed, and a quality pitcher from that side, did you view yourself as a switch pitcher? Did you have a hard time being taken seriously? Like, did you think switch pitching was your ticket to the next level, or was it a thing you did but you felt good about yourself right-handed?
I never felt as I was anything but a switch pitcher. I was what I had known since I started. It's how I competed in high school. And I didn't know enough about the game at the higher levels at the time to think about it rationally. Had I thought about it rationally, I probably would have never gone very far. But it was one of those things where you just kept working, finding ways to get better, finding new wrinkles each year. And I was a late developer. You know, when I got to college is when I finally started to grow a little bit. And that's what kind of took me to that next level as far as efficiency from both sides. Cause even in high school, I was a very average pitcher. I had to walk on at Creighton, and then Coach Service had me come on as a right-hander with the ability to prove that I could pitch with both hands. And that's how it was throughout the minor league and major league levels as well, where I was given the opportunity, you know, show us what you can do. If you can do it, we're not going to stop you from doing it.
You know, I'm looking forward to diving in on conversations about like tinkering with your arsenal and figuring out each. But the question I thought about was the thing, PFPs, would you like run through the line twice from each hand? Like, were you doing double work there? Because like fielding that bunt or that squib down the third base line is a lot different left-handed than it is right-handed.
So for your listeners that don't understand the third baseline bunt, if you're a left-handed pitcher, you have to drop step, turn your body and throw. To eliminate that in high school, what I would do, even if I was pitching left-handed, I would just throw my glove off and I would go
sick.
Feel the ball right-handed, rock and throw. Now, as you climb the ranks, you're going to get more pushback from coaches. And I practiced enough to where I got just as efficient as a left-hander fielding those bunts and getting the footwork down as right-handed. But it is double the work. Everything that you can think of is double the work. I mean, you're playing catch twice every day. You're throwing double bullpens. Because if you're not, you're falling behind. You don't have that luxury to just take half the reps. If you're doing that, you're not going to stay up with the rest of the competition.
It does seem more efficient to just drop the glove though, because down to the one down the third baseline, if you're trying to make the play at third, it behooves you to be left-handed. If you're trying to make the play at first, it's a little easier to be right-handed. Like, man, they should have just let you roll with that.
Well, and I didn't try to do it. Nobody ever told me to stop, but I just kind of went, I was like, oh, I better just figure out how to field the position left-handed.
Yeah, with that though, as you're like putting from the work aspect, so were you like long tossing? Is it stretch it out with one arm, bring that partner all the way back, stretch it out with the second arm, bullpen? Were you switching off mid pen? Were you doing one side, then the other side? Like how long did it take you to, I guess, harness, this is the way that I feel like I get best when it comes to my training?
So from a catch perspective, I had some good teammates, but I never ran across one that wanted a long toss twice in a day. So I would go out early with the starters. And I'm speaking in pro ball. You go out at 2:30 with your group of starting pitchers who's going to throw their bullpens that day. And then reliever stretch was usually about an hour later. So one hand, there was, you know, some thought behind it. Maybe if I pitched the night before, if I thought I was going to have more of a workload one way that night, kind of dictated which way I would go first. I would go out with the starters, long toss with them, do their stretching, do their whole routine, come back in, do flat ground, and then join the reliever stretch, you know, an hour later, and then do the same thing again from the other side. So I was able to get both those, you know, throwing sessions done. And thankfully, I had a lot of good catchers over the years that would just saddle up and catch back-to-back bullpens. I truly appreciate that more than those guys will know. But if you have a 50-pitch bullpen, you got a catcher back there that's got to catch 100 pitches. And I would switch back and forth throughout those bullpens, but it was double the effort.
And glove-wise, I remember when you got called up, there was a big thing about, like, you know, this is the custom glove you're wearing and things like that. Were you able to source something like that when you were a kid, when you were in high school, when you were in college?
I got my first one of those when I was 7. My dad faxed print of my hand. He traced my hand, faxed it to the Mizuno factory in Osaka, Japan, because they had made one for Greg Harris at the time. And to this day, Mizuno, to my knowledge, does not make these gloves. It was for me that they started that in 2000, or no, it would have been 1992. And then they made my last one in 2021. So it was just one of those things where I've had one of those since I was 7. People ask me all the time, does it feel weird? A regular glove feels weird to me, just because it's the only thing I know is a six-fingered glove with a pocket in the middle. So it was efficient to have that, and those are some of my most prized possessions.
I'm sure. So you get into Creighton, and it's you've got to prove yourself as a lefty or as someone who can loop in the left-handed side of your game. When did the conversation about dropping down to sidearm, like how much tweaking came before, okay, maybe I'm going to try as a sidearmer?
There was no tweaking that came before. It never entered my mind. I knew baseball my whole life, but until you play at the higher levels, there are certain things that you just don't process unless you have professional coaches or parents that played in the big leagues telling you to do these type of things. I didn't even know what like a left on left, right on right advantage was leaving high school. It wasn't something I thought about. And now it's obviously a big part of what I thought about. But with that, I had a really rough freshman year. I did not perform well, especially left-handed. I didn't perform really well right-handed either. But the coach kind of said, hey, we're going to need to figure something out here. This just isn't going to work out. So it was the first thing we tried, and that was dropping down. And it was one of those things where it just felt so comfortable so early. And I have a double-jointed middle finger, which allowed me to spin the baseball a lot firmer than I can for my right side. and I was able to drop down sidearm, and the slider just came really easy to me. And it was a really hard pitch, especially at that level at that time, for left-handed hitters to pick up on. There was very few that, you know, could process what was happening, the ball coming at them, going away from them, and being able to handle that. So that allowed me to get to that right hand a little bit more. And before long, my left hand was probably more effective than my right.
I was going to ask, was there ever any sort of consideration in your mind to stick with one side or the other as you got, you know, as you got into college or got older?
No, I you know what your scouting report is, you know how you grade out. And I knew that there wasn't a single thing I was going to be able to provide, either just right-handed or just left-handed, to get that opportunity at the professional level. Now, as things progressed, and I moved along from AAA to the big leagues and then started to get some, you know, platoon statistics going, there was a path left-handed. And that's kind of how I was picked up after those first two stints with the A's and then the Mariners, or excuse me, the A's and Blue Jays. Kind of from that point on, teams were picking me up as a left-on-left reliever with the ability to kind of go a little bit longer from the right side, if that makes sense.
Yeah, because, I mean, as a switch pitcher, you would throw majority of your at-bats would be right-handed typically.
Yeah, so that's how it works out.
Yeah, so it's an interesting concept. So when you obviously when you get to pro ball, there's a, you know, there's the Pat Vendetti rule. But before then, how would you, in high school, if you ever encountered a switch hitter, or in college when I'd imagine there was at least a few more, how would that situation come to fruition? Like, who decides, you know, is it just like a, you know, like an old West showdown of like, who's going to saddle up on one side?
Honestly, it goes back to me not understanding what a matchup advantage was in high school. There was no rhyme or reason to why I would switch. It was like, oh, okay, let's switch to this guy. And now,
so you'd have a righty come up and be like, I'm going to throw this guy left-handed.
And this was eliminated a little bit because in the summer season, we played Legion baseball in Nebraska. I would start Fridays either right or left-handed, and then I would start Sundays with the opposite hand. So I wasn't switching a lot back and forth in between games for the bulk of our, you know, season, which is the summer season. So it wasn't as much of an issue then. But then when I got to college, it was the left-on-left, right-on-right advantage.
You're the first person I've had on the show from Creighton. I don't think I've actually ever talked to someone who went to Creighton. Obviously, everyone spends the entire college baseball season trying to get to Omaha. Would you guys play games, I guess, in Rosenblatt? Would you get games in Rosenblatt? Like, how much time did you spend there as this looming specter of college baseball postseason? But just it's right in your home city.
I spent a bulk of my childhood at Rosenblatt. I grew up a mile from there. So my family lives kind of right in between the new ballpark and the old ballpark, less than a mile from each. So I would go to all the Royals games. I was a Royals bat boy, the Omaha Royals at the time. Where they're still there, the AAA affiliate of the Kansas City Royals. They're now the Storm Chasers. So I grew up going to Rosenblatt all the time. And half of our games, my junior and senior year at Creighton, were at Rosenblatt. So it was a pretty awesome feeling to be able to play there, where there was just so many memories that I had.
Well, especially because at that time, your junior and senior year, it was kind of known that Rosenblatt was on its way out. TD was coming in. I would love your opinion. I got to go to the 08 College World Series. It was the only one I've been to, and it was at Rosenblatt, which is really cool. Just as a local, as a college baseball fan, you know, what were the general thoughts among your family, just as fans, the transition from Rosenblatt to, I guess, it's Charles Schwab now, but what was TD Ameritrade?
You know, it was tough to process at first. But then if you go to the event now, the area around the ballpark is so much more conducive for the amount of fans that come in, and there's so much more space and things to do. Rosenblatt served its purpose and did a phenomenal job for all those years. But to me, the new home is there at Charles Schwab, and it's an amazing fan experience to be a part of that. And it's why you see the attendance like it is year in and year out. People love going there from out of town, and there's no town like Omaha that supports amateur events quite like they do, and they put on a heck of a show.
So once you drop down left-handed and as you get through college, you become less of a fun oddity, this thing that you can do, to a pretty elite college baseball pitcher. You start racking up accolades. You've got sub-2 ERAs. You're having success in the Northwoods League and summer ball. What did you, you mentioned earlier, you hear your scouting reports. What did you start to hear as you got into junior year, senior year, when you got drafted both years? Like, how were your chances of being a professional being conveyed to you as what teams thought you might be?
Yeah, that honestly kind of came out of nowhere. I was kind of just going along until my junior year, even into my junior year. We got into like March and it was just kind of average, maybe a little better than that at times. But I remember I had like a 40 some inning streak of scoreless baseball for almost 2 months coming out of the bullpen. And that's when things started to come in a little bit more, where I was hearing from more scouts and, you know, you would see more people at the games with the radar guns up and things like that. But even as the draft approached in 2007, I think I was told I'd go anywhere from 8 to 20. And I knew right away. I said, okay, well, that's probably not going to be enough money for me to forego my senior year at Creighton. But I said, let's see what happens. And sure enough, I think in the 45th round that year, I finally got drafted. There was some calls early on, but I was throwing out a number that was like top 2 or 3 round money that I clearly wasn't going to get. And I understood that, and I don't blame them. And then the next year I knew that it was a senior type thing, so I was going to take whatever I got. And that was when I went in the 20th round there by the Yankees.
In that 2007, when he got drafted as a junior, that was still back in the day when they could spend anything they wanted. There were no restrictions as far as bonus pools or anything. Did conversations come up as you got closer to August 15th? Did anything get close to materializing, or like, it wasn't from the moment you got drafted, you were like, I'm going back to Creighton?
You know, they felt me back out in like July, if I remember, but I think I asked for like $400,000 or something like that is what it was going to take to get me away from going to my senior year. Fortunately, I had, you know, my parents were very realistic about how those signing bonuses are spent and just how quick that can go and the importance of finishing school first. So my dad and my mom, especially my dad, was on me to get back to school and finish that out. So I think I threw that number out, and that was probably the last phone call I got until the next year.
As you're in like that really long scoreless streak, there's general pressure in college baseball games because every single one matters. It's different than like, you know, 162 big league games. Like if you drop one in June, like you drop one in June. In college, everything matters for getting into the tournament, yeah. Your weekend series especially. Was there more pressure when you started coming in like midway through that streak about the outcome of the game, or like, I got this streak, man. I can't give up a run here.
I honestly, at the time, I didn't even think about it. We were so tied in. We were having a good run that year. We were in contention for a regional. And Coach Service there at Creighton does a phenomenal job. He's been there, I think, 21 years now, to where he just brings everybody together and kind of gets a common goal in place. I was so tied into finding a way to get to regionals, it never entered my brain. And I think it was, I remember when it ended, it was in the conference championship game against Wichita State. It was like in the 6th inning, I gave up a run, but we were up 5-1. And I didn't even process that the streak was over. I was just so excited we were ahead. But that was a pretty cool night. And this takes us back to a little bit about what you were saying earlier about that right hand. Coach Stevenson was not convinced that I was a better pitcher from the left side compared to the right. So he put 7 lefties in the lineup against me that night. And they had some big leaguers in there. Connor Gillespie was on that team.
He was first round pick.
Yeah,
either him or his brother was a first round pick.
And it was him. Actually, he might have been a third. Either way, they're both good, great players.
Yeah,
yeah. And then Damon Sublett would have been on that team. There was some strong talent that was there, but fortunately that night was able to pitch pretty well and got us our first conference championship.
With that, I mean, that gets you, you know, gets you into the college baseball postseason. You know, it's again going back to everyone's trying to get to Omaha. You guys are, you know, it means you guys have to travel. What's the difference in college baseball regionals are so odd because it's like it's unlike, say, the weekend. You know, the week you're a team that is built to win 2 out of 3 games, hopefully 3 out of 3 games. Regionals becomes this all hands on deck kind of thing. What does that do to someone who has, you probably had a much more unique and arduous routine than all the other pitchers when you're trying to stay hot in regionals or conference tournament?
Yeah, my routine didn't change a whole lot. I would just long toss before the games, and then I was coming anywhere from the second inning to the ninth, kind of that longer reliever role too, just depending on what was needed. So I did what I had to do to be ready, and then just went out and competed in the games. And then those off days, I would usually just throw a little bit because I knew I'd be in there again the next day. I think I had close to 100 innings out of the pen that year. So it was quite a bit of work.
So as you sign with the Yankees after your senior year, you know, every organization has its different development benchmarks or things they want to do with pitchers, or, you know, different coordinators want to put their touch on some guy or whatever. You are an incredibly unique case. What was, and if at all, what was the Yankees, you know, they get you in the organization. Was there we want you to start doing this or change this, or we think you're this, or was it like, hey man, you're a unique case. You kind of figure it out.
You with the Yankees, you get there and sure, the first, second round, third round pick, they're going to get a little bit more fine detail as far as, hey, this is your plan going forward. This is what we're going to work on. As a 20th round senior pick, you're just kind of a bonus. Anything they get out of you is seen as a plus. So they kind of just let the reins loose and say, hey, go compete, show us what you can do. And that first really year and a half, there wasn't a whole lot of changing anything. I was still over the top right-handed. But after that, like second and third year, that's when I was up to double A. There was some more fine tuning. Coach Phelps in double A, who's now with the Marlins, Tommy Phelps taught me a cutter, added some different wrinkles in. And I was getting attention, but it was more along the lines of what can you do to be more efficient in these outings and what wrinkles can we add? Because at that point, I'm never going to be a velocity guy. I am what I am, 87 to 89 right-handed, and at the time, 83 to 85 left-handed. You're going to have to find other ways to get guys out. And that's where they were very helpful. They're kind of ushering new pitches and strategic efforts in and out of games to get that done.
What ended up becoming your best combo? Because I listened to an interview you did with Pitcher List, that from left-handed, you, especially once you figure out how to spin that slider, you can kind of fastball slider guy there. Being right-handed and a right-handed reliever, like you said, as a high 80s velocity guy, takes a lot more nuance. What ended up becoming, when you were at your best, because you turned in some great years, like what was, you know, the repertoire that you found worked for you right-handed?
Right-handed, it was that drop-down slider, change-up, fastball combo. Each day would be a little bit different. Honestly, the things that probably made the most difference as I got older, I would face these guys over and over and over again. And I only had a few pitches. So I would have to figure out other ways to get them out. So the 10th time you face a guy, he's seen all of your pitches. He knows where they move. He knows kind of how you attack them. So I started to incorporate changing the arm angle from both sides. Over the top would be more of a curveball, change up from up there. And then the biggest thing was the timing and the delivery, where I would add in quick pitches, change the hold patterns, double leg lifts, stuff you see, you know, the guys are doing a little bit more today. Not quite to
Nestor Cortez's level.
Yeah. Yeah. Cortez from the Yankees. I didn't do anything that crazy. I felt like if I'm doing that along with the two-handed thing, I'd probably just get kicked out of baseball. But I would try all that stuff to, you know, see how you could throw off these hitters' timings, because so much of what they do is predicated off of something they've practiced over and over and over again. And anything you can do to disrupt that is very beneficial.
If you've heard us talk about HelloFresh before, I wouldn't be surprised if you wonder, okay, is this really as good as they make it sound? And I tell you, listener, it is. And I say that because I am a HelloFresh success story. I say that because I'm not the chef. I'm not the cook in our house. But with HelloFresh, I've become one who can actually be part of the food prep, cooking dinner rotation. Generally, it's breakfast for dinner or something on the grill if dad's expected to cook. because that's just not who, I don't have those skills. HelloFresh gave me those skills. Why? Because they're quick and easy meals with the instructions that both have written and pictures have allowed me to take the ingredients, do exactly what they tell me to do, and at the end of the day, produce a meal that my family said, wow, that's pretty good. And for them to say that's pretty good when I'm making dinner, that is a miracle. HelloFresh does that for you. It does it for me. And it also gives you the flexibility. You can pick out on their app what food you want to eat. Takes a couple of minutes. They'll deliver it to you. And not only that, but they'll do it in portions that also help me, because I have a tendency to eat as much as on my plate. They give you just the right amount of food, whether it's for two, whether it's for four, they proportion it out for you. So if you want to check out HelloFresh like I have, go to HelloFresh.com/BaseballAmerica14. That's BaseballAmerica with the numbers 1-4. Use that code for up to 14 free meals, including free shipping. That's HelloFresh.com/BaseballAmerica14. You can get America's number one meal kit with HelloFresh.
What, as far as like strategy for doing that, so like much smaller scale frame of reference, like when I was a senior in college in D2, I would drop down and throw a fastball or slider every now and then, just as like if someone was like fouling a bunch of stuff off or it got deep in a bat, like were there other triggers that you saw as, okay, this is at this point I'm going to do something funky with my timing, or this is the call for, dropping down low, especially in the upper minors as you get better scouting reports? Like, were there certain indicators of, okay, this would be the right situation to change something up?
Yeah, it depends on who the hitter is, really. You know, you try to do something like that to Joey Votto, it doesn't do much. He has such a disciplined approach and can change with you and knows what he's going to do. He's one of those guys where you just kind of go up there, you compete and hope for the best. Now, the guys I would do the timing things on are the guys with the bigger leg kicks. Nomar Mazzara's and guys like that that have these huge leg kicks that at a point in your delivery, they're starting that. So it was really kind of dependent on who the hitter was, would kind of dictate how they were approached. And if it was a guy that, you know, was shorter to the ball, that was really hard to strike out, that's maybe where I would kind of incorporate some more of that stuff, as opposed to like a free swinging guy that, you know, if you execute pitches, you're going to be able to get him. And if you miss, he's going to get you.
As you get into the high minors and you start putting up pretty solid minor league seasons, you're having decent success or good success in the Mexican League and in winter ball. Did you feel like at some point you've put yourself in the organization's plans, or is it still like I'm scratching, clawing, fighting, and I don't know if there's a path for me?
With the Yankees, I always had that hope that I was going to be able to run out of the bullpen there in the Bronx. I knew it was going to be a long shot. Back then, especially, they would acquire free agents. They would do whatever it took to win. And they were a very, very good team at the time. I knew it was going to be kind of a long shot. By the time I got to that seventh year in Scranton, June came around and they transitioned to me into starting games because they wanted to see what I could do as like a 3-4 inning guy. And at that point I was like, okay, if I can string together some of these here, I'm going to have a shot. Kept holding on hope. And then late August came around that last year, and my agent reached out to Cashman, and that's when, you know, I was told that it was not going to be with them. And I was glad they were honest with me rather than me re-signing there that following year when I was a free agent. It kind of told me like, hey, you need to get somewhere else to where you're going to get that, you know, at least chance to pitch in the big league. So even though I didn't get up with them, I will be forever grateful that that was the organization that drafted me, because they do such a phenomenal job of training you on how to be a professional and what it takes, no matter the organization you're with, from a discipline standpoint, from a grooming standpoint, you know, with the sideburns at the middle of the year, no long hair, collared shirt on at all times. They do things the right way, and it prepares you to go to any other organization and be just fine.
With that, you get to minor league free agency after that 2014 season. And as I would say one of the more desired types of minor league free agents, it's the kind of profile that you see has good success in getting picked up in the Rule 5 draft and as a minor league free agent of pitching depth who has had success at the AAA level, which means that you, in all likelihood, could contribute to the big league roster. What kind of market did you see for yourself? It's not the, you know, it's not the getting courted on private jets kind of free agency, but I would imagine that there was at least like you had some choice in where you got to go.
Yeah, that first year there, I had no idea what to expect. I had no idea how the process worked, but I did know the day it started. And I was a little nervous going into it, but I felt a lot better because I think I had like 5 calls come in within the first 2 hours of that morning. The A's were the first team to call. And I always told myself, you want to get to the team that seems like they want you the most. That was always my thought process in the free agency offseason, especially on the minor league side. It wasn't who does this team have in their bullpen? Like who are the best? Like, I didn't care. I just wanted to get to the place to where I felt they wanted me most. And I think every year I was a free agent, I ended up signing with the team that called me first.
Is there a pitch involved when they're trying to get you to come in? Or is it a simple like, hey, we want you for this roster spot, this salary, invite to big league spring? Is there like a Pat, we have a direction for you that we would like to see you in?
Yeah, I mean, back then, minor league salary was the same as it was when I started. Or, you know, it was like $1,100 a month in rookie ball, $1,600 in double A, $2,100 in AAA. So I had like a number in my head. I'm like, okay, if they give me anything over, I think it was like 10 grand a month is what I said it at that first year, in an invite to spring training, I'm going to sign there. And then it obviously goes up as you get more experience at the AAA levels. You're able to command a more strong monthly salary. And that changed as the years went on a little bit. But that first year, once I got to that threshold of a dollar amount and a big league opportunity, I knew I was signing. A big league camp opportunity, that is.
With that, I mean, walk me through the call. You seemingly picked the right organization to get that opportunity.
Yeah, they had said that they liked my splits. They appreciated the advantages I would get, and then the length. They weren't sure exactly how they were going to use me. They said they had been keeping track of me for years, and I knew Oakland was a team that valued minor league success. Some teams do, some teams only care about that scouting report. So that played a role too. And then getting to that organization and being able to play for Bob Melvin and Kurt Young and Steve Scarsoni in AAA and Don Schulze, the pitching coach down there, I couldn't have picked a better spot to land.
With that, what's the, you know, getting the actual call? What is the, where'd you find out? Who are you calling first? And what was, I always love the logistics. It never sounds like someone gets the call and it's a normal, okay, you got some time, you can get a flight in the morning. It always seems like it's just a mad dash.
This was crazy. So we had the AAA game of the week in Nashville that night. We were playing Salt Lake City and there was a microphone down in the bullpen and we got to like extra innings and I was always pitching in tight games, like either the 7th, 8th, or 9th. And I didn't get called in that day. I didn't think much of it. I was like, oh, maybe it was another, you know, just they wanted me to have another day of rest or something. So I go inside and I get called into the manager's office. Steve called me in and Don was sitting there with him, the pitching coach. And the first thing that I thought of was like, oh no, that game was on TV. Did I say something inappropriate? Not that I sit down there and like, I'm horrible, but like, I was like, what happened? Cause we had 4 guys on the 40 man at the time in AAA that getting called up was the furthest thing from my mind. But then the way it worked out was I had an out in my contract like a week later and Scar was like, hey, I hear you're going to take this out. I'm like, I didn't say that. What are you talking about? He's like, are you planning to take it? I'm like, I don't know. Should I? And that's when he told me, he's like, it's a good thing you're not going to take it because you're getting called up to the big leagues. And we were in Boston the next night. But the coolest part of that, like, when I left his office, every guy from the team was just huddled outside the door waiting for me and like just mobbed me because it was almost 8 years in the making. And those guys know kind of what I went through. They were going through it too. Some guys had been up, some guys were still on that climb up, but just their excitement for me made it feel so good. And then the rest of the story is a crazy one. I go and pick up the apartment with my wife And we get on a flight to New York, or we're supposed to leave for New York at 7 a.m. to catch a connector to get us to Boston. And it just kept getting delayed, delayed, delayed. Finally didn't get in till New York till like 4:30, left there, landed in Boston at like 6:45 for a 7 o'clock game. But they had told me at 2 o'clock that they had already made the roster move. So whether I got in that night or the next day, I was there, which made me feel a lot better, because you've heard of guys that if they don't get there, they get sent back down. Sometimes you don't get that call again, if you start pitching poorly. So I roll up to Fenway. They don't have like the players' entrance is shut off like once the game starts. So I had to enter with the fans. I got dropped off in a taxi. They didn't send a car service or anything. So I hailed a cab at the airport with my giant A's bag and tried to convince the people at the gates that I was a player. After some phone calls, I got in there. It was probably like the second inning. I get in the clubhouse. Fenway clubhouse is tiny. Tyler Clifford was our closer at the time. He was taking a nap, so I had to kind of quell my excitement, be quiet for him. Got dressed, and I'll never forget this one. I went and shook Bob and Kurt's hand, and then Stephen Vogt, who was the catcher at the time, now managing the Guardians, pulled me aside and he said, "Pat, I want you to do me a favor." He said, "When this inning ends, I want you to walk as slow as you can from the dugout to the foul line. And then give me your best show jog from the foul line to the bullpen." And he said, "Take in every second of this." And I'm just so happy he did, because he really slowed down that moment for me, put it all into perspective. And then 3 innings later, I was in the game pitching 2 innings that night.
How, on a scale of like, I don't know how I would say this, but like that first outing in the show, like, yes, it is the first outing and stuff, and you're, the three decks, it's at Fenway, all that stuff. Like, you still have a job to do. At some point, you get the second inning, which is the big, like, it's like the okay, you get to come in, you get to collect yourself. Did it ever feel normal at any point during those 6 outs?
No, and I've just seen so many horror stories of guys' first outings in the big leagues and them just being so rocky. And I had called my college coach that morning, and he had instilled some of the best advice I ever had. He said, "Pat, just throw strike one." He said, "The rest will take care of itself." And I was just so centered around just getting ahead of that first hitter. And I'll be honest with you, I aimed right down the middle. I could barely feel the baseball. I had no clue where it was going to that first hitter. And then things kind of slowed in after that. I think Brock Holt was the first guy I faced, got him to ground
A
out.
switch hitter was the first guy you faced.
No, Holt's a lefty.
Is he a lefty yet? Why did I think he was a
Yeah.
switch hitter?
No, Holt's a lefty. I faced Swihart. Swihart's the
Oh,
switch hitter
Swihart is a
there.
switch hitter, yes.
And it was kind of fortunate for me. I had come up with all these Red Sox guys playing against them constantly in the minor league. So like Mookie Betts, Swihart, Holt. I had faced these guys so much, even though they were incredible hitters, I had success against them in the minor leagues. So it kind of evened out the fact that Sandoval was there, Big Poppy was there, Hanley Ramirez was there, just because I had some sort of like, okay, I've gotten these guys out before. And now looking back, I should have been terrified more than anything of Mookie Betts, the player that he is.
Yeah, I mean
But I just,
that's two Hall of Famers in that lineup between Poppy and Mookie eventually.
it's crazy. Yeah. And
Imagine letting a guy like that go. Imagine trading a guy like that. Who would do that?
it's crazy. But yeah, he what a value Mookie brings to any team he's a part of. It's yeah.
With that, we haven't talked about the Pat Vendetti rule. So you're facing Swihart, and you're the one the rule that got put in place. So you're the one that has to declare. Which seems like it's punishing the harder skill. There's one of you. There's been a zillion switch hitters. Was there? I mean, it's not like you have a say in the rule, but were you peeved about it? Like.
No, I mean, it was what it was. And with Swihart, I had faced him so much coming up with the Yankees that I faced him every time pitching left-handed. And that's where the confusion came, because I had completely forgotten in the dugout, Bob Melvin said, "You're going to attack Swihart right-handed." Because every time I'd faced him to that point was me pitching left-handed, him hitting right-handed. And even, I think he had a walk-off off me in Double A one in Portland 1 year,
He had a
me
great
pitching
year on the
left on right.
comeback.
And then, so I forgot. So I told Blake that I was going to pitch left-handed, which just wasn't true. And then I, kind of talked to the umpire a little bit, told him, "Hey, I messed that up. Sorry, the moment's kind of spinning a little fast for me here." And then got that all sorted out. And yeah.
So was that all like pre-picked and like, especially once you got to the big leagues or even like AAA, like when you guys were going, you know, you'd before a series or whatever, it's like, hey, these are the switch hitters in the lineup. Was it just, okay, Pat, you're going to face this guy that handed, or was it ever like, man, I just feel like I'm spinning a lot better left-handed today. Like, let's go with that.
All predetermined by things like their splits, the field. Obviously you want as many right-handed hitters compared to left-handed hitters, guys hitting right-handed there have that short porch in left, and then it's the opposite in right field, you know, as you get into those gaps there. So you want those guys to be, you know, turned around if you can. But as the years went on, it was crazy to see just the difference in scouting reports from 15 when I first got in until my last year, 20, where, you know, you kind of had a little pregame meeting, went over things. And then by the time 18 rolls around, I'm with the Dodgers, you know, Mark Pryor has a detailed list of like, okay, this is how your stuff plays against each one of these hitters. This is how we're going to attack them. So no longer was it a scouting report based on the hitter. It was now a scouting report based on what you have and what the numbers say give you the best chance to get this guy out.
You mentioned being with the Dodgers, and you, after that season with the A's, you start doing the DFA loop. You're, you know, you're over in Oakland, Toronto, Seattle, LA, all their affiliates. How much random gear do you have in your house, or did you have?
I have so many hats that I hope my son one day appreciates, and so many different bags and uniforms that, you know, I'm holding on to in the hopes that, you know, one day we can kind of go through that stuff and tell some stories. But yeah, I got a lot of stuff.
And you did all this before there was a minor league CBA and these teams were required to provide housing. And you did this as a married guy. Like, how many different apartments, how like short-term leases and things like that? Like, how many times have you moved? Did you move in a 4-year span?
Oh, I have never done the math. That should be something I do, but thankfully I have a wife that is extremely supportive. She came around for the wild ride. She had found out she was pregnant with our son, our first one, in 2016. We were in playing Pawtucket. I was supposed to start that night. And then I get a call saying, hey, don't bother coming to the field. You just got traded to Seattle. Your flight leaves in the morning. So I had to call her, who was back in Buffalo at our apartment, just hanging out. I was like, hey, sweetheart, got to move all the way across the country.
That's about as far a flight as you can get in minor league baseball from Buffalo to Tacoma.
We had our car out there too. So thankfully her mom was able to come out, help her get packed up. And you need an army as far as the support system goes, not only from a spouse perspective, from a family perspective, people who are understanding of, you know, the job and what it takes. And until you're in it, you don't truly understand what these guys go through.
You get a cup of coffee in the COVID season. And then, you know, what was the linchpin in deciding to hang it up?
Yeah, it was one of those things. From the day I got called up, I knew coming with each offseason, there was going to be a discussion to be had with my wife. Is this the best thing to do going forward? And we got to the point to where once it was no longer the best thing financially to do, that would be time to hang it up. And I'd never gotten past January without having a job with an invite to spring training. And then once February rolled around in March, I thought to myself, you know, I'm not in camp right now. I think it was in February still, where I'm not in camp right now. And even if I do get to camp, it's going to take, you know, a lot to get called back up. And then next year I get to this point to where I'm putting off an eventual business career. At some point I knew that I was going to have to shut that down. And once I didn't have that concrete offer, I gave the word to my now current employer. I said, I'm done with baseball. That's it. And then on the second day of the job, the Dodgers called and wanted me to come to their, what do they call that? The remote training camp in 21 or whatever, or the alternate training site in 2021. And I was like, you know what? I gave my word. That's it.
Life in extended spring. Not fun.
No. And then I think it was at UCLA that year because they were still using COVID guys, I think, or however that was. I remember sitting with my boss and like, just go do it. This job will be here. And I'm like, nah, this is one of those things that it's been a while coming. And I think the writing's kind of on the wall, because even that COVID year in 20, I pitched well in the opportunities that I had. I think I struck out Freddie Freeman with like a 79 mile an hour fastball. I'm like, there's only so long this can last.
That's a good one to end it on, though. That's like, if you're gonna have one of your last K's be that, that's pretty good. It's another Hall of
Yeah,
Famer.
I don't know how many 70-mile-an-hour fastball strikeouts there's been in the big league, so
Dude,
I knew it was
you and
about
Jamie
time.
Moyer are racking them up. If you could go back and give yourself a pep talk at 22 when you signed with the Yankees, what would that pep talk look like?
You know what? Man, don't think about things logically, because I didn't, and I'm glad I didn't, because had I done that, I wouldn't have. And the other thing would have been just attack a little bit more. That last year in 20, I had nothing to lose. I didn't get invited back to that to the original spring training once it resumed from COVID, and then the team had a COVID outbreak. Otherwise, I probably wouldn't even have got another opportunity that year. And it was just kind of like, let it fly. You got nothing to lose. And I would have told myself a little bit sooner, even when you get to the big leagues, just maybe a few more pitches, aim right down the middle, and just rather than trying to be so fine. But everything is, 2020 when you can go back and look at it. And I have one of those journeys that I'm so grateful for. It's hard to look back at any of it and have any regrets.
I got a quick rapid fire for you, then I'll let you get out of here.
All right.
Favorite minor league ballpark?
Ooh. That's a great question. But Richmond County Bank Ballpark on the Hudson in Staten Island with, the postcards from heaven, looking in between where the Twin Towers used to stand, and just the whole Manhattan skyline with the ferry being there, the Statue of Liberty in the background. There's some sweet ballparks, but that one was the best.
Favorite big league ballpark?
Probably Yankee Stadium. Same city. That's a hell of a place.
Best hitter you ever faced?
Ah, Mike Trout.
It's a good pick. Best
Yeah.
Omaha food spot?
Wow. You are going to get me in a lot of trouble. You are going to get me in so much trouble. I don't even know if I can answer this. I'm going to name my favorite pizza spot in Omaha. It's La Casa Pizza on Leavenworth there. And I hope those that are going to the College World Series can check it out.
Last one, everyone gets this. Do you have a nightmare bus ride story from the minor leagues?
Oh my God, I have so many of those. We could fill three podcasts with these.
Have done a couple. I think I've done multiple episodes that are just compilations of these nightmare bus ride stories.
this is a Venezuela winter ball story. It could get graphic. I'm not going to let it get there, but the guys told me not to eat any of the fruit until I got adjusted over there to the, living. But we had just landed in Caracas, and they had this beautiful looking pineapple smoothie, the airport. Bought it, get to the bus. Immediate regret. I got so sick on that bus, and it was one of the most disgusting buses I've ever been a part of. And we landed and had like a 2-hour drive through the hillside of Venezuela. And
Oof.
there was like no AC on the bus, sweating through my clothes, sick. It was something I'll never forget.
That is a true nightmare.
They told me not to eat the fruit, though.
They you were warned. You
I
were
didn't listen.
warned. Pat, that is all I've got for you. Thank you so much for joining from Phenom to the Farm.
Was awesome. Thanks.
You got it, man. And that's it for today's episode of From Phenom to the Farm. Big thanks to Pat Vendetti for stopping by, walking us through his journey. If you enjoy the show, please subscribe wherever you get your podcast, and we'll see you in 2 weeks. Thanks for listening.